Part 1. The Mechanisms of Denial. Chapter 1. The Orphaned Truth. Truth, for me, was never abstract philosophy. It was seared into me by the chaos of my childhood, a lens of clarity I never asked for. Long before I had terms like systemic failure or cognitive dissonance, I knew the stomach-deep weight of contradictions I couldn't reconcile. These weren't intellectual puzzles, they were the texture of my world, the backdrop of my formative years. Later I would joke about it as my trauma XP, not the kind that grants cool new abilities, unless you count a permanent debuff to trust in institutions and a +10 bonus to spotting hypocrisy at 50 paces. Footnote: the term XP is derived from the words experience points as found in gaming. A prelude in denial. The rock and the fire truck. The incoherence of our family story crystallized for me in an incident in third grade. During the chaos of lunch recess, my friends issued a challenge: throw a rock at the next truck. It was a pointless act, born of playground pressures, but the fear of being left out is a powerful force for a child. I picked up a rock. A big red fire truck drove past. I threw, not expecting to hit it, just impulsively trying to belong. Then the sound, a sharp crack, a spider web spreading across the windshield. My stomach plummeted. I hadn't meant to damage anything, but I had. I was caught and suspended. Later, in the principal's office, my grandmother, my legal guardian, convinced him she would handle it, acting with a stern parental authority I hardly recognized. My fear curdled into something else, a strange, defiant rage. "You're not going to do anything," I said to her. "You never do." There was an expletive in there as well. Why say that? Why challenge my legal guardian, the only person representing stability, after doing something so clearly wrong? Because I already sensed a pattern. Disaster would strike, and afterward, a baffling, suffocating silence would always descend. Watching my family felt like being trapped in a slow-motion crash I was powerless to stop, a maddening frustration that simmered just below consciousness. And here's the kicker. I was right. She didn't do anything about the rock. No punishment, no grounding. The cracked windshield, the suspension, my outburst, all of it was never spoken of again. It simply vanished into the family's Bermuda Triangle of uncomfortable truths, a mysterious region where accountability went to die alongside mismatched socks and car keys. This silence was its own form of orphaning. The truth of my action, my fear, my defiance, my almost explicit request for a parent who cared, all of it was swallowed by the silence. The lesson was reinforced. In my universe, reality was frighteningly negotiable. That negotiation, however, was about to escalate from a cracked windshield to shattered bone.
Skipping pages 13 through 16. La 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 la. And resuming. This history, this score, isn't destiny, but it is an explanation. It illuminates how the same workings that failed to acknowledge my reality operate at every level of society, creating a vast architecture of denial I would spend my adult life learning to dissect. This book is about piercing the comforting thought that everything is fine, a delusion brilliantly satirized by the comedy duo Mitchell and Webb. This book charts a voyage from orphaned truths as crushing weight to beacons of hard-won clarity, from shipwreck survivor to lighthouse keeper. It is the insider-outsider's path to take what once oppressed and make it illuminate, to hold truth not only with clarity, but with purpose. Chapter 2. The Tyranny of Certainty, The Mathematics of Betrayal, and Our Draped Ape Nature. Carrying the orphaned truths of the last chapter, rewires one's relationship with certainty, breeding a deep allergy to easy answers. What begins as raw calibration, the accumulation of trauma XP with each invalidated reality, quickly hardens into skepticism, less a philosophy than a survival tool. It tunes you to the low-grade fever of cognitive dissonance when words clash with actions, a tension others seemed able to ignore with baffling ease. Out of this vigilance crystallized a heuristic, a rule of thumb forged in environments thick with denial. Never trust an absolutist. What began as private defense becomes an invitation to intellectual vigilance, because from the precarious vantage point of the insider-outsider, you learn that truth rarely arrives in binaries. It shimmers with complexity, bristles with contradiction, and refuses easy categorization. The rule endures as a coping mechanism born not only of that realization, but also of the complicit silence that lets denial fester.
The problem: the brittle confidence of authority. An unease rooted deep in my childhood, an intuition honed by a chaotic early life, found its name years later in Socrates. Before that encounter, however, I recall many galling interactions with authority figures, teachers, administrators, managers, and even well-meaning friends who radiated an aura of absolute certainty. These individuals weren't always malicious. Many likely believed they acted with laudable clarity and conviction, perhaps even for the greater good. Yet they operated from an unshakable faith in their own frameworks. From my vantage point, already attuned to the world's inconsistencies by the real violence of the knife fight and its systemic dismissal, their certainty felt brittle, a towering confidence built on an uninspected foundation. It felt like watching naive realism in action, the unshakable belief that one's perception of reality is the only correct one. Any difference in perception is a sign of another's defect. In such environments, dissent was rarely treated as an opportunity for dialogue or deeper understanding. It was typically framed as disruption, a sign of being difficult, or perhaps damaged. My attempts to question inconsistencies, fueled by the hyper-awareness of early trauma, were frequently met with condescension. "That's just how it is," they might say. Or, "You're thinking too much." Or, "How dare you suggest X?" And the classic, "Because I said so." Each dismissal has a translation. "Stop questioning the things I consider unquestionable. Your reality doesn't fit the approved narrative." This atmosphere of distrust, where one risks being excluded, labeled problematic, or jeopardizing one's standing, inevitably breeds fear and self-censorship. One learns to acquiesce to the dominant certainty, even when internal doubts scream and protest. As the old line goes, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? I have been told I am too sensitive, perhaps too empathetic. Maybe. Yet, when I observe the willful blindness that defines so much of public and private life, I cannot help but think they are not sensitive enough. I must continuously check myself here. Is that a genuine observation or my own potential superiority bias, a common pitfall for the chronically misunderstood, peeking through? It is a delicate and crucial line. The Socratic Antidote and the Castle of Certainty. It took me years to find the conceptual language for what I instinctively sensed in those early interactions. Then I encountered Socrates, and his approach resonated deeply. When the oracle at Delphi pronounced him the wisest man in Greece, Socrates was puzzled. His foundational principle was the antithesis of certainty. "One thing only I know," he famously declared, "and that is that I know nothing." He concluded the oracle must have meant he was wiser only because he didn't claim to know what he did not know. This Socratic humility, embracing ignorance or at least acknowledging its vastness, is the ultimate rebuke to the absolutist mindset. It reframes certainty not as a strength, but as a potential symptom of unexamined assumptions. It is a lesson I have had to learn and relearn,
often through my own humbling encounters with premature judgment. My own journey with Robert Greene's work is a case in point. Years ago, I bought the 48 Laws of Power, but let it gather dust. When I finally picked it up, I made a classic mistake. I skipped the introduction, went straight to the first chapter, and promptly dismissed the book as a cynical manual for sociopaths. It wasn't until much later when I heard Greene explain his work was descriptive and not prescriptive, unmasking how power has operated, and certainly not advocating for such behavior, that I realized my leaky memory and initial judgment had been a perfect example of the rigid and myopic thinking I aimed to avoid. It was a humbling reminder of how easily my own certainty could lead me astray, and a lesson in the value of what ancient philosophers called practical wisdom, the ability to navigate complex realities with a clear-eyed perspective. The Socratic method offers a potent antidote to this insulated certainty. Its genius lies not in winning debates, but in cooperatively dismantling false confidence from the inside out. It's a process of shared inquiry, a way of asking questions to reveal the contradictions in our thinking. As Ward Farnsworth notes in The Socratic Method, a practitioner's handbook, its goal is to show that a claim must be in some way unsatisfactory to the person who made it. It targets the internal contradiction, the point where a belief leads to an untenable consequence. This is harder to dismiss than external evidence. One can't attack the author of a study when the study examines one's own mind. Socrates wasn't attacking the person, but the person's argument. He contrasted the comfortable love of holding opinions with the rigorous love of testing them. This distinction crystallized a principle for me over the years that serves as a powerful diagnostic tool for any conversation. Argue to understand, not to win. The moment you sense someone is arguing to win, you have learned something vital. You have found the perimeter of their curiosity, the boundary of a protected belief, the wall of their ideological fortress. Their goal is no longer discovery, it is defense. And there is rarely a good reason to engage with a fortress. Socrates viewed unacknowledged ignorance masquerading as knowledge as a kind of moral failing, the ignorance involving the conceit of knowledge.
Data box, the conceit of knowledge. Socrates considered this as the most dangerous form of ignorance, not just being ignorant of a subject, but being ignorant of one's own ignorance. This double ignorance, believing you know something when you do not, prevents any possibility of learning, as the person sees no need to inquire further. But if Socrates offers the antidote, where does the poison of unyielding conviction take hold? It seeps into the one environment that guarantees its survival, profound isolation. Herein lies the mechanism behind the absolutist's confidence. End of data box. As journalist Evan Osnos observes, such isolation is a kind of petri dish for distortion, breeding pronouncements utterly divorced from common human experience. He notes how the building of walls, both literally around people's estates, but also psychologically and emotionally, has become so complete that we are now living in an arrangement that is much closer to what it was like in medieval Europe. These modern castles do not merely protect, they concentrate the toxin, intensifying its effects until detachment becomes second nature. When a figure like Elon Musk declares that the greatest flaw of Western civilization is empathy, Osnos suggests it is a tell about how divorced his life had become from the lives of most other human beings. Such statements are the native tongue of certainty, steeped in its own fumes, nurtured in what Osnos calls the amniotic fluid of agreement, an echo chamber where absolutism circulates unchallenged. A clinical diagnosis, the draped ape, and varieties of stupidity. This struggle against premature certainty is vital because, as the Greeks observed, leaders operating from unshakable convictions can be catastrophically dangerous. How then do we identify this intellectual rot, especially when it's packaged as strength? Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker offered a surprisingly resonant, if unconventional, idiot detection system. He argued that the most reliable indicator of a particular kind of dangerous idiot isn't a lack of intellect, but the raw, unmistakable presence of cruelty.
Cruelty, Pritzker elaborated, frequently comes from a failure to override primal instincts of fear and judgment. Kindness, conversely, requires empathy and considered judgment, evolved states of being that demand the mental capacity to step past our most reactive urges. This unevolved state, this regression to primal instinct, is the behavioral signal of a deeper foundational truth, precisely the truth I try to capture with the draped apes perspective. This brings me to a concept that requires careful handling, stupidity. I use the word not as an insult, but as a clinical term for a phenomenon crucial to this book's diagnosis of denial. The draped apes framework is offered not as a judgment, but as a starting point for empathy, rooted in acknowledging universal fallibility, myself emphatically included. This perspective posits that all humans, irrespective of intellect or education, share an inherent cognitive architecture. We are, in essence, primates draped in the finery of complex thought, but the animal remains. We are still operating with minds prone to bias and self-deception. This draped ape nature is not about a lack of intelligence. It is our shared human condition, a baseline susceptibility to flawed thinking that helps explain why seemingly intelligent people and entire systems can reach incoherent conclusions. This inherent fallibility is so deep-seated that even our most sophisticated AIs currently struggle when attempting to process illogical or emotionally defended human input. The AI's challenge mirrors our own. How does one constructively engage with assertions that defy basic reason? Pritzker's cruelty indicator aligns with this. The cruel individual, by failing to engage higher empathic pathways, is perhaps operating closer to the unadorned primal ape level. The draped ape's concept of inherent cognitive fallibility differs, yet complements other important perspectives on stupidity, a subject for which, it seems, the world never runs out of new flavors to sample.
Data Box. Cipolla's Basic Laws of Human Stupidity. Italian economic historian Carlo Cipolla, in his satirical yet earnest essay, The Basic Laws of Human Stupidity, approached the issue from an almost economic outcome-oriented perspective. He wasn't focused on IQ or intent, but on the impact of actions. First law. Always and inevitably, everyone underestimates the number of stupid individuals in circulation. Second law, the probability that a certain person is stupid is independent of any other characteristic of that person. Stupidity, in his model, is found in equal proportion across all groups, regardless of education, class, gender, intelligence, etc. Third law, the golden law. A stupid person is a person who causes losses to another person or a group of persons while himself deriving no gain and even possibly incurring losses. This framework has four types of people. The helpless or unfortunate, harms self, benefits others. The intelligent, benefits self, benefits others. The bandit, benefits self, harms others, and the stupid, harms others, harms or gains nothing for self. Fourth law, non-stupid people always underestimate the damaging power of stupid individuals. In particular, non-stupid people constantly forget that dealing with and or associating with stupid people always turns out to be a costly mistake, regardless of time, place, or circumstance. Fifth law. A stupid person is the most dangerous type of person, more dangerous than a bandit, because their actions are irrational and unpredictable, making them harder to guard against or reason with. End of Data Box.
Data Box Bonhoeffer on Stupidity, a Moral Failing. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German theologian, writing his Letters and Papers from Prison before his execution by the Nazis, proposed a theory of stupidity distinct from intellectual deficiency, a moral, not intellectual defect. For Bonhoeffer, this stupidity was primarily a moral failing. He observed that intellectually brilliant people could be stupid in this sense, while intellectually simple people might not be. He saw it as less an innate lack of capacity and more a chosen or conditioned abdication of responsibility. Socially induced. Stupidity, in this view, is often acquired under the pressure of power or strong social movements. Individuals can be made stupid by surrendering their independent judgment and critical faculties to the collective or charismatic leaders. Susceptible to slogans. The stupid person is easily swayed by slogans, catchphrases, and prevailing narratives, losing the ability to assess situations independently or question dominant ideologies. Dangerous and difficult to counter. Bonhoeffer considered this type of stupidity more dangerous than malice because the stupid person is often self-satisfied, closed off to reason, and thus easily manipulated into becoming a tool for destructive ends. The argument, he noted, is often futile against such entrenched, socially reinforced conformity. He saw it as a psychological and sociological phenomenon where individuals, under overwhelming external pressures, political, social, or psychological, abdicate their inner independence and their responsibility for critical thought. End of data box. While their approaches differ, the draped ape's perspective offers a unifying insight. This inherent fallibility is the fertile soil for the moral abdication Bonhoeffer described, the destructive irrationality Cipolla catalogued, and the cruelty Pritzker identified. These are not separate phenomena, but the bitter fruits that sprout when our vulnerabilities go unexamined. To clarify these frameworks, the table in the paperback book offers a visual comparative analysis of this multifaceted irrationality.
The Political Consequence, The Mathematics of Betrayal. Understanding our draped ape's nature helps explain why absolutism is so seductive. If we are all prone to err in confusion, latching onto a straightforward, unwavering narrative can feel like a lifeline, a way to silence the internal static of doubt. Certainty can feel like an antidote to the discomfort of our inherent cognitive limitations. The absolutist, in their rigid certainty, commonly displays a profound lack of empathy for differing views, a trait aligning with Pritzker's definition of cruelty as a failure of evolved understanding. This environment enables the authoritarian backlash Osnos describes. This is the great risk for authoritarians, either in private business or in public office, he explains, is that you become so insulated and comfortable. It's like this kind of amniotic fluid of agreement around you that nobody who disagrees with you stays very long. And as a result, you make, actually sometimes, terrible mistakes. This amniotic fluid of agreement is the absolutist's castle, a space created not only by the noise of supporters, but by the enabling silence of the comfortable. The consequences are predictable: misjudgments of the public mood and catastrophic strategic errors. Osnos cites examples like the Shah of Iran hosting a lavish party months before the revolution, or the uproarious applause in Moscow for the plan to invade Ukraine, as perfect illustrations of this dangerous insulation. This pattern extends beyond heads of state. It is a deep lesson in the problem of becoming too far ahead, too far isolated. Even figures like Mark Zuckerberg, on his weird tour of the United States wanting to meet humans, suffered from this insulation. As a former employee told Osnos, there was nobody around him who could and would tell him that it looked ridiculous. This isolation is also characteristic of what scholars term a sultanic oligarch, a figure Osnos applies to leaders like Putin. This leader is essentially agreed upon by the other elites to let one among them rule. But the danger is that kind of seclusion and that kind of absence of any sort of critical thinking and judgment around you. The result? Disastrous decisions are born of unchallenged certainty.
This kind of absolutism, the insistence of simple, binary, unquestionable answers for complex issues, the love of holding opinions rather than rigorously testing them, is the ideal psychological and political kindling for denial. It demands that one ignore contradictory evidence, dismiss inconvenient facts, and silence dissenting voices, both external and internal. It thrives not only on the noise it creates, but on the silence it compels. Driven by fear, the allure of easy answers, or tribal loyalty, it forces a choice of sides, usually based on emotional affiliation rather than critical assessment. It short-circuits the messy, difficult, yet essential work of grappling with complexity, the kind of work the insider-outsider perspective demands simply for survival, and the same work Socratic inquiry embodies. This difficulty in dismantling baseless certainty, this overwhelm of dissection, becomes crippling when confronted with systemic tactics like the fire hose of falsehoods. It leads to exhaustion and a retreat from engagement, inadvertently allowing flawed ideas to persist. But why does this absolutism resonate so strongly, particularly in the American context? It's not merely individual psychology at play. There's a deep cultural current here, a persistent strain of American anti-intellectualism that views expertise with suspicion and, sometimes bafflingly, seems to value ignorance as a form of populist virtue. Common sense, often redefined as just a bundle of unexamined biases and gut feelings, is valorized over rigorous analysis or specialized knowledge. Being perceived as too smart or too educated can be framed as being out of touch, elitist, or somehow untrustworthy. This anti-intellectual climate can also serve as a defense mechanism against intellectual insecurity. If one fears their own draped ape's limitations, attacking or dismissing complex ideas can feel safer than engaging with them and potentially exposing those limitations. Historian Richard Hofstadter traced these anti-intellectual roots further, identifying a historical tension between democratic egalitarianism, where every opinion feels equally valid regardless of expertise, and the hierarchical nature of specialized knowledge. He also noted how certain strands of evangelical evangelicalism, by prioritizing faith and direct emotional experience over theological reasoning or intellectual inquiry, contributed to a climate where questioning established beliefs could be seen as suspect or even hostile. When ignorance can be framed as authenticity and certainty as strength, the soil is perfectly tilled for Bonhoeffer's moral stupidity to take root. It's not just a personal failing, it is tapping into a powerful, recurring cultural script that actively resists the Socratic call for humility and rigorous examination. The cruel pronouncements of an absolutist, in this light, might be seen not as a sign of strength, but as a symptom of this cultural script, enabling an unevolved, Pritzker-esque idiocy. To understand the deep origins of this script, why a society might become so unmoored from shared standards that absolutism feels like a viable alternative, a recent essay by David Brooks, channeling the work of the late moral philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre, offers a powerful historical lens. MacIntyre argued that the Enlightenment, for all its great achievements, inadvertently created a moral vacuum. It replaced a world where your purpose was inherited, defined by duty to family, community, and a craft with its own intrinsic standards of excellence, with a world centered on the autonomous individual. In this new order, morality was privatized, becoming a matter of personal preference. This is the philosophical bedrock of the false economy of comfort. If truth is relative, then comfort and preference become the highest goods. Brooks suggests that a figure like Donald Trump thrives in this environment because he intuits that the language of a shared moral order no longer holds power for many. Instead of appealing to that fractured framework, he speaks directly to the languages of the modern individual in a moral vacuum. Preference, I want. Power. I have the leverage, and self-interest. He uses institutions not to be formed by their traditions of excellence, but as a stage on which to perform, a purely instrumental goal. This deep cultural current of anti-intellectualism and resentment can light a fire. It provides the perfect political kindling for one of the most powerful and dangerous forces in the modern world. populism. It is the political manifestation of the absolutist mindset, a strategy that weaponizes grievance and offers the false comfort of simple enemies and heroic saviors. Data box. Populism, the politics of the false economy. Populism is not a complete ideology like socialism or libertarian, but rather a political style or logic that can attach itself to various ideologies. Its core feature is a moralistic division of society into two camps. The pure people, a virtuous, authentic, and hardworking majority who are the legitimate heart of the nation. And the corrupt elite, a self-serving and often immoral cabal of politicians, financiers, academics, and media figures who have betrayed or exploited the people. End of data box. Populism style can manifest on both the left and the right. Left-wing populism typically identifies the elite as corporate and financial powers. Right-wing populism often defines the elite more broadly to include cultural institutions and intellectuals, while defining the people in more narrower nativist or nationalist terms that frequently exclude immigrants and minorities.
But to understand why this grievance is so potent, why populations become susceptible to leaders who tell them the future is stolen, we must get analytical. We need a tool that can quantify betrayal itself. We find it in finance, the discount rate, or R. The time value of money can be confusing because we rarely describe money with its full definition, which must also include time. An assigned dollar value is arguably the most popular yardstick in the world, but it is intrinsically linked to time. In its purest form, the inseparable relationship of time and money is the mathematics of trust. Data box, the metaphor of the discount rate, R, how we price the future. In finance, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. The discount rate, R, is the mathematical expression of risk, the number that quantifies our confidence in a future promise. The symbol R takes on many names across a range of disciplines: interest rate, rate of return on investment, inflation rate, certainty, risk, confidence, long-term cost of capital, social discount rate, etc. But its core function remains the same. It is how we price the future. A low R means low risk and high trust. A high R means high risk and low trust. The book details the formula to relate a present value with a future value. In this equation, you only need to know the time period, T, and the rate, R. It's not necessary to understand the mathematics of the equation. The important point is that this translates numbers from one point in time to another point in time. End of data box. This audio version skips some sections in the chapter. La la la. And resuming the chapter. In a stable, credible society, the discount rate is low. In this stable society, it's easy to ignore the complexity of time because it doesn't seem all that consequential. We trust that promises will be kept. We are willing to invest for the long term in education, in infrastructure, in relationships, because we believe that future value is real. The American dream is a low R proposition. It only functions when citizens have a baseline trust that their work today will have a secure value tomorrow. When that trust evaporates, when people's lived experience tells them their personal R is astronomical, the entire social contract fractures. This is the engine of populism. Populist leaders don't create the high R environment, they find it. They find a population already living there, people who feel in their bones that the system's promises are worth much less than advertised. And how does the system signal your R? Look no further than your credit card statement. When a bank assigns you an interest rate of 25%, it is making a cold, calculated statement about your perceived risk. It is telling you that the promise of your future repayment is so uncertain that they demand an extreme premium. For millions, this isn't an abstract insult. It is a constant, tangible reminder from the system that they are considered a high-risk bet, their future heavily discounted.
This is why absolutism and the simplistic narratives of populism are so seductive in high R environments. When the future feels worthless, the messy, long-term work of democratic compromise seems pointless. Why invest in a future if you don't believe it will arrive? In its place, the absolutist offers something that feels more valuable in the present: the emotional catharsis of blaming a designated enemy, the tribal security of belonging, and the intoxicating promise of a strong leader who will simply seize a better future rather than asking you to invest in a broken one. Populism doesn't do debate, it does enemies. It claims to speak for the real people while dismissing everyone else as part of a corrupt elite. No nuance, no compromise, no room for disagreement. Just a clean, comforting, and utterly fraudulent map. Your struggles aren't complicated, they're caused by those people. This framework is the perfect political expression of the false economy of comfort. It offers seductively simple answers to complex anxieties by providing a clear external enemy to blame. It's politics as a blood sport. Experts, distrusted. Institutions, rigged. Opponents, not wrong, but evil. This isn't just anti-establishment, it's anti-pluralism, reducing democracy to a zero-sum war where only one side gets to be the people. The rest are traitors, outsiders, or fools. As a deeply anti-intellectual style, it views expertise and institutional knowledge as tools of the corrupt elite. This appeals directly to the draped ape's tribal instincts and desire for efficient, emotionally resonant narratives that bypass critical thought. It works because it feeds on real pain. When people feel betrayed by broken promises, see Chapter 6, populism hands them a scapegoat: immigrants, intellectuals, coastal elites. The anger is justified, but the target is a distraction. The press becomes fake news. Courts are painted as corrupt, and minorities are cast as threats. By framing political opponents not as legitimate adversaries, but as enemies of the people, it erodes democratic norms, justifies attacks on institutions like the press and judiciary, and demonizes minorities. Yes, sometimes it shakes up a complacent system, but its endgame is always the same. You're either with the people or you're against them, and history shows what comes next. This anti-intellectual soil is tragically fertile ground for propaganda tactics like the fire hose of falsehoods. The populist frame, which has already established an untrustworthy elite and a virtuous people, preemptively discredits critical media and academic sources, making its audience more receptive to alternative narratives, however outlandish. Such strategies do not just present lies, they overwhelm the public square with so many contradictions and inflammatory claims that the sheer effort required for critical thought becomes insurmountable. The fire hose exploits our cognitive limits, making the Socratic path of careful examination seem prohibitively difficult and exhausting. Why engage in the demanding work of sorting fact from fiction when it is easier to pick a side or retreat into the comforting certainty of an absolutist narrative? This tactic weaponizes anti-intellectualism, deliberately inducing the cognitive exhaustion and brain break, Chapter 3, that discourage good faith engagement. This dynamic is not confined to politics. It appears in corporate cultures where questioning the official narrative is career suicide, and in families where an unspoken rule forbids acknowledging a glaring, uncomfortable truth. The linguistic markers are often revealing. Always, never, everyone knows, it's just common sense. These are the phrases of a mind closing itself to inquiry, of critical faculties disengaging in favor of certainty. This certainty is often amplified by a conviction that feels suspiciously like the Dunning-Kruger effect, the conceit of knowledge Socrates warned against, where incompetence masks itself with unearned confidence. This is not a theoretical foible. Consider Peter Navarro, a former White House advisor with a Harvard PhD, who in his own books repeatedly cited the analysis of an expert named Ron Vara, an anagram of Peter Navarro. He was, literally, citing himself to validate his own arguments in a closed loop of self-regard. It is a near-perfect, if pathetic, demonstration of the conceit of knowledge in action and how hollow credentials can be. Databox. The Dunning-Kruger Effect. Named after a 1999 study inspired by the case of MacArthur Wheeler, a man who robbed two banks after covering his face in lemon juice. He believed, with total conviction, that lemon juice would make him invisible to security cameras, a fact he had learned about its properties as an ingredient in invisible ink. His subsequent surprise at being identified and arrested was genuine. The researchers, Dunning and Kruger, demonstrated that for a given skill, the most incompetent individuals are not only poor performers, but also lack the metacognitive ability to recognize their own ineptitude. Their incompetence robs them of the exact tools needed to spot their incompetence. However, the often missed secondary lesson is that this cognitive blind spot is universal. We all possess domains of incompetence where we are susceptible to this effect. The danger is mistaking the small, well-lit territory of our knowledge for the entire continent. Recognizing this universal human frailty, that we are all draped apes, is the Socratic starting point for intellectual humility. End of data box. From the draped apes' perspective, this hubris is both predictable and perilous. Recognizing our shared potential for such flawed thinking is not cynicism, it is the necessary foundation for guarding against it in ourselves and in the systems we build. This choice between critical examination and absolutist certainty is a dangerous fork in the road, because reality is messy, complex, and ambiguous. Pretending otherwise leaves one not just wrong, but perilously vulnerable. It allows manipulators to hijack narratives by offering simple falsehoods or by overwhelming the capacity for rational thought with sheer volume. This creates catastrophic blind spots, both personal and societal, as vital information is actively ignored. Ultimately, it can lead to a surprisingly malleable morality where core ethical principles are bent or discarded to fit the demands of the absolute narrative. When one refuses to grapple with complexity, prioritizes the comfort of holding opinions over the difficult work of testing them against reality, or when manipulative noise inflates the cost of critical engagement, we cede the ground to those selling the illusion of certainty. Choosing this path, the comfort of the absolute over the Socratic path of critical thought and facing uncomfortable truths, isn't only an intellectual error. It is a surrender, a flight of responsibility that creates the psychological vulnerability populist leaders exploit to transform personal denial into a collective political force. And historically, it is how ordinary people, convinced of their own righteousness, become complicit in terrible things. Bonhoeffer provides a crucial lens on the moral dimension of certainty-driven stupidity. Chipola's framework reminds us of the danger posed by this kind of irrationality, particularly when they manifest in actions that harm others without any rational benefit. Chipola's third law, as we've seen, defines the stupid person by their effect, someone who causes losses to others while deriving no gain and potentially even incurring losses themselves. This isn't the calculated self-interest of the bandit. This is harm without rational purpose. According to Chipola's fifth law, this makes the stupid person the most dangerous type of person because their actions are fundamentally irrational and therefore unpredictable. Pritzker's observation that cruelty usually accompanies this kind of idiocy adds another layer. The irrational actions are not just unpredictable, but potentially driven by a lack of empathy, making them all the more damaging. This synthesis of moral, behavioral, and outcome-based failure brings us to a specific political archetype who embodies all these dangers, the useful idiot. Here, the frameworks of Bonhoeffer and Chipola converge in their most potent political expression. The useful idiot is the Bonhoeffer's morally compromised person who has abdicated critical thought for the comfort of ideology. Simultaneously, they are the Chipola's stupid person, causing immense harm to the social order for no personal gain, all while serving the interests of a bandit leader.
Data box: The Useful Idiot, The Politics of Weaponized Naivete. The term useful idiot, often attributed to Vladimir Lenin, refers to a person who propagandizes for a cause without fully comprehending its cynical goals. They are the naive, often idealistic believers manipulated by the cause's leadership. It describes a profound asymmetry of knowledge and intent. The user, a cynical leader or state, understands the true, often brutal objectives. The idiot, the supporter, accepts the public-facing, idealistic narrative at face value. The useful idiot provides a powerful service to the manipulator. They grant a veneer of moral legitimacy, intellectual credibility, or grassroots authenticity to a cynical agenda. Crucially, the useful idiot is seen by the manipulator as a disposable tool. Once their utility is exhausted, or they begin to grasp the true nature of the cause, they are typically discarded or purged. End of data box. This is the end stage consequence of the tyranny of certainty. The absolutist leader, operating from within their amniotic fluid of agreement, requires a legion of followers who have accepted the simple narrative. These followers, suffering from what Socrates called the conceit of knowledge, believe they possess a unique and virtuous insight into the world's problems. In reality, they are merely echoing the talking points of the manipulators who prey on the promise trauma, chapter 6, and high-art desperation this chapter describes. They become the unwitting foot soldiers in a war against nuance and complexity, mobilized against a foundational principle of a healthy democracy, that those who disagree are not enemies to be purged, but fellow citizens to be engaged. Sopolis' first law. Always and inevitably, everyone underestimates the number of stupid individuals in circulation, is itself an absolute statement, an ironic detail. Does this law, by its absolutist framing, invite the same skepticism this chapter advocates? Perhaps if taken as unyielding dogma. Yet its real utility lies not in its literal, unassailable truth, but in its power as a provocative insight. It forces us to confront a persistent human blind spot, our systemic failure to account for the pervasive and typically underestimated element of irrationality in human affairs. If we interpret the stupidity Sopola describes not as a fixed individual trait, but as a potential for anyone to act in damagingly irrational ways, a potential inherent in our draped ape nature, then his first law serves as a critical reminder. We are all prone to underestimating the frequency and impact of such actions, both in others and, crucially, in ourselves. This underestimation, Sopola's fourth law, non-stupid people consistently underestimate the damaging power of stupid individuals, is perhaps because the anti-intellectual currents in our culture make us hesitant to call out irrationality for what it is, mistaking the conceit of knowledge for actual competence, or cruelty for strength. So the heuristic, never trust an absolutist, is more than a personal shield. It is a practical defense against the danger Sopola identified, a moral safeguard against the conformity Bonhoeffer warned of, and a necessary expression of the humility required to acknowledge our shared draped ape nature. This rule is a reminder, grounded in painful experience and bolstered by thinkers observing the phenomenon from different angles. It warns that anyone demanding you silence your own questions, ignore your observations, and abandon nuance is waving a red flag. Such a person is not just morally compromised, they are a fundamentally irrational and underestimated danger, perhaps even signaling their flawed thinking through acts of cruelty. And chances are, they have good reason to fear the Socratic questions that threaten to dismantle their fragile certainty and expose the emptiness within.